right, we're studying the book of Daniel. Daniel is a 15-year-old boy in the year 605. He lives amidst the large royal family there in Judea. He's been trained and raised up. He's a fine-looking young man, he and his friends. And Nebuchadnezzar comes and conquers Judea and hauls off the first wave of captives back to Babylon. And with them goes all of the royal family, everybody who can organize trouble against them, including these young men. And in the normal way that things happen, Nebuchadnezzar sorts the group out. All the young women go to the harem or someplace like that. All the soldiers get themselves killed. The old guys get left back. And the young fellows are brought to put to labor in his world. And in this particular case, if you're a smart young fellow like Daniel and his friend Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you might luck out and get put into the court or the group of the king's eunuchs, where you get to learn and study and grow for 3-4 years until you're smart enough or enculturated enough to grow up in his kingdom. And that's what happens to Daniel and his friends. And right away, we see that Daniel and his friends are committed to their relationship with the Lord. Daniel grew up during a time of the great revival, the great end revival in Judea under King Josiah. King Josiah became king at a time when there hadn't been much in the way of devotion toward Yahweh for a long time. And while his ministers were cleaning out the old temple, which was mostly, was pretty much largely being used as a storage bin, they had some sacrifices going on in there that wouldn't be pleasing to God, and some other things. They found the book of the law. And when they found the book of the law, they suddenly realized that they were in gross violation of their relationship with God. And Josiah mounted a great revival in the land so that the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom, began to return to the Lord in droves. And Daniel and his friends grew up in the middle of all that. So they were on fire for God and excited and whatever. And so when they came to this particular scenario where they were deprived of their manhood and put into slavery for the rest of their life, they responded out of a deep sense of faith in God and trust in God that he would meet them in these horrible circumstances, in this horrible situation. And when it came time for them to be fed according to the diet and the menu the king assigned for his young trainees, the food that was offered to them was not appropriate for young Jewish boys. And so they asked permission to not eat it, and to eat vegetables and stuff instead, so they wouldn't be violating their covenant. And they were quite prepared to refuse to eat it and take whatever penalty. But the head of the eunuchs, Ashpenaz, I think Ashpenaz is his name, if I remember correctly, he liked these young men, and so he said, I will do that, but I can't afford for you to start looking puny, because then the king would take it out on me. So Daniel suggested a trial period where they would eat nothing but vegetables and things that were in their diet. And after a while, it became obvious that diet was going to sustain them quite nicely. In fact, they were looking more robust than some of the other people. And so they passed that test. The next thing that happened was the king had a dream, a very wild dream, and he asked his soothsayers, wise men, to come in and to interpret the dream for him. They came in to do that. And they said, what's the dream? And he said, well, I'm going to tell you the dream. If you're wise at all, if you have any interpretation at all, any skill, any insight, you'll be able to tell me the dream as well as the interpretation. Make a long story short, they couldn't do that. They were getting ready to all get killed. And Daniel said, wait a minute, Yahweh can do that. And Daniel comes in and interprets and tells the man what his dream was and then interprets it. And has to do with the emergence of four great kingdoms that relate that flow out of Nebuchadnezzar and relate actually to the history of the people of Israel going forward for the rest of time. And we've begun to talk about some of those kingdoms. We're going to talk about them more as we go along. But the first kingdom, the head of gold on this statue, was the kingdom of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, to be followed by a bust of silver, which was Media Persia, belly of bronze, which was Alexander the Macedonians and his group, and then legs and feet of iron and clay, which were the Romans, both in the near-term frame and then down through history as well. And we'll get into that more as we study these kingdoms again. Daniel reveals the dream to him. He's right about what the dream was. And he tells Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold, and these other countries or empires are going to flow from you. So he passes that test. And because of his great wisdom, he and his friends are elevated, brought to a place of high council in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. Much in the same way the story of Joseph down in Egypt, as he was brought in as a young slave and by circumstances came into the house of Pharaoh to interpret a dream that the Pharaoh was having trouble with, and gave Pharaoh the right dream, gave him the strategy for dealing with the answer to the dream, and wound up becoming the number two man in all the world, the chief administrator for the most powerful man in the world. And that was Joseph's story. It's also Daniel's story. Now, moving along, because we've already covered all this. But then what happens is Nebuchadnezzar gets all excited about this statue that he had his dream of, and he creates this big 90-foot steel has all this stuff writing on it and all these this imagery that he has had this dream on. And he commands that everyone should bow down and worship it, and if they don't, then they're to be killed. Partly the reason why he does this is because he's sort of manipulated by the enemies of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because they know that they won't bow down to this. And sure enough, it becomes reported that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down. The king commands them to do so or else be thrown into a brick kiln furnace, which is a room about this size that they use to heat brick up with. They refuse to bow down. They say, Lord will deliver us. But if he doesn't, we won't bow down because he's still God, even if he doesn't deliver us. So they bind him up, they throw him in the furnace, and in the furnace, another one meets them, one like the Son of God, and walks around inside the furnace with them. Their bonds are burned off, the rest of them are unharmed, and Nebuchadnezzar is so amazed at this particular thing, he calls for them to come out, and the men who go to get them out are consumed by fire, or the men who put them in actually were consumed by fire. So the fire harms everybody but our three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the lesson is that God will, if he doesn't deliver us from the furnace, will meet us in the furnace, and that the difficulty that we face, if we approach it right, if we have the right attitude and meet it with faith, will not harm anything but take our bonds away from us. It will cleanse us of our bonds. And so we had this particular story, and once again we see the stock of Daniel, Shadrach, and Abednego, Meshach and Abednego, rising so that Daniel's now the second in all of the land. Then we have we get a little time under the belt, and we see that Daniel has been having so much influence on Nebuchadnezzar that he and Nebuchadnezzar are able to have the conversation that Yahweh is the Most High God, and that he needs to acknowledge Yahweh. And Daniel warns Nebuchadnezzar that if he does not humble himself before Yahweh, that Yahweh is going to humiliate him or humble him or abase him, bring him down. And sure enough, the fourth chapter of Daniel is the written testimony of Nebuchadnezzar, one of the most despotic men who ever lived, ruthless and brutal, of his own humiliation before the Lord, how God brought him down, and his eventual acknowledgement that Yahweh is the Most High God, and that everyone must acknowledge that Yahweh is the Most High God. And we see the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar, as it were, by the ongoing life and ministry of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and in particular their response to difficulty and how they handle various things, their operation in faith. And so that was the fourth chapter that we read. And we're in the fifth chapter. Any questions so far before I launch? The handwriting on the wall. Every phrase or idiom like this has a source. And the handwriting on the wall, this is the source of that phrase. Daniel 5:1. Let me see, make sure I don't get it wrong on here. Okay. Daniel 5:1. Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, and actually the word means grandfather, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, his concubines, might drink from them. They brought in the gold vessels they had taken out of the temple, the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And the king and his noble and his wives and his concubines drank from them. And they drank wine, and they praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. Now, let me stop for just a minute here to set this up a little bit. Daniel has now been in captivity for a fairly long period of time. He is... Nebuchadnezzar is gone. His son Nabonidus is now the emperor. And Nabonidus is off in eternal warfare. He's off constantly trying to conquer everything, everybody. And he is left behind to rule his kingdom, Belshazzar, his rich playboy son. Now, Belshazzar's never done a day's work in his life. He's never been to war. He's done nothing whatsoever to recommend him. And what he mostly majors in is partying. And when you do nothing but party all the time, you're under this constant pressure that the next party is better than the one before it. And before you know it, you've spun out of control in terms of your partying. So Belshazzar is having a party. By this time, remember, Nebuchadnezzar is now gone. Nabonidus is taken over. And by this time, Daniel is in semi-retirement. And this is later in the game. And so he's not in the same place of power and authority that he was under Nebuchadnezzar. He's sort of, like I said, in semi-retirement. Now, they're having this party, and they're bored with the usual things, and so Belshazzar has somehow or another picked up on the fact that his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, once captured from the temple in Jerusalem all of these gold objects for worship and for drinking and eating and cups and everything for the worship there, all of which were dedicated to Yahweh, all of which had gotten hauled off in the original captivity in 605. Now, just on a lark, he decides that they ought to go get those things, bring them up so he can show off his treasure house, and they ought to enjoy the party drinking out of these implements. And while they're about it, they ought to decide to go ahead and praise gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Bad move. They're using the implements of God's worship and praising other gods. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. So, right up here on this wall up here, a hand appears and it begins to write on the wall. Then the king's face grew pale and his thoughts alarmed him and his hip joints went slack. Now that is an idiom. Yeah, that is an idiom, and that means that he now needs a diaper. That's what that means. That's a nice way to say that. He's lost control below the hips there. That's the least of his problems. I'll tell you. There's a number of. It depends on how much Hebrew you know, and I don't know a whole lot, but it's funny what, you know, it's a Hebrew idiom, and there's others like it. So at any rate, this guy is having a problem. His knees began knocking together, and the king called aloud to bring the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed in purple, have a necklace of gold around his neck, and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." Okay? So whenever these guys get in trouble, they always call in their magi. This is the land of the Magi. The Persians called them Magi, but it's all the same group of people. It's the diviners, conjurers, the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans were actually a race of Persians that had grown up in the midst of all of this and were known for their wisdom. Abraham, you remember, was from Ur of the Chaldees, which was an area over in the Fertile Crescent Valley of the two rivers, four rivers actually. So they call these guys in and said, "If you can interpret this, then I'm going to honor you before all the people. I'm going to make you wealthy, and I'm going to give you charge of third of the kingdom." Now, Nabonidus is first in charge of the kingdom, and Belshazzar is second. So third was the next. It was the next thing he could do if he could figure this out. So if you can read this and interpret it. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. And then Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. So I've said a lot of this. He's having a party for 1,000 elders. It's very public. His father's off to war. He's a rich playboy. Never done much. Brought the temple vessels out. And I think I've covered most of this. So God sends him a message, the handwriting on the wall. And he offers to enrich whoever can do this. Okay, let me move on for a minute. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. And the queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale." And this is actually the queen mother. We'll just take my word for that. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems was found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now that's a business card, don't you think there? The Daniel... extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, solving of difficult problems. Call 54999. Okay. And so this guy, he was around when your father, and it's actually your grandfather, was king, and so he was good at this kind of thing. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. Probably Belshazzar, this rich boy playboy prince, has heard of this Daniel and by reputation been around, but he hasn't had anything to do with him. He doesn't run in those circles. He and Nabonidus don't go in the same direction that Nebuchadnezzar went, so he hasn't had a lot of contact with him. So if the queen mother comes in and reminds him that there's this guy around who can handle these kinds of things. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Are you that guy? Now I have heard about you, that you have a spirit of the gods in you, that illumination, insight, extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now, the wise men, the conjurers, were brought in before me. They might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said to the king, "Keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him." So he's brought in, the offer is made to him, and he declines the riches and honors, but agrees to translate the writing. Now, the last thing you want to be is the captain of the sinking ship. And when Daniel sees what's up on the wall, he has no temptation whatsoever to become in charge of this thing, especially because he understands what's going on. The other thing is at this particular point in time, who needs to be third in an inferior kingdom when you used to be second in a superior kingdom? It's not what he wants. He says, "I don't need what you offer. Keep it for yourself or give it to someone else. You're not going to have it long anyway." But he said, "I'll read it for you." So Daniel is not in it for the money or the power. He's already been second in authority of the kingdom. Why do we want to be third, especially since it's about to fall? Only the bottom of us could really grant this authority anyway. I mean, this is one of those kind of things where, you know, the real king is gone, and the young pup is making all this stuff. And everybody knows that when Nabonidus comes back, if Nabonidus comes back, whatever happened in this time frame is subject to judgment. Besides, the interpretation is not going to bless you, and when I get done telling you what this means, you're not going to want to give me anything but a beating. Any promotion Daniel would get from Belshazzar would not last long. "O king, the Most High God has granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father." He granted him all of that. "Because of the grandeur which he bestowed upon him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed. Whomever he wished, he spared life. Whomever he wished, he elevated. Whomever he wished, he humbled." So your grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, was chief among all the men of all the earth. His kingdom ruled the earth. You were superpower. You were the superpower of his day when he was here. And God elevated him to that particular position and gave him that kind of stature in his day. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. He was driven away from mankind. His heart was made like that of beasts. His dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized the Most High God is the ruler over the realm of mankind, and he sets it over whomever he wishes. So we heard the story last week of how Daniel had warned Nebuchadnezzar that he needed to honor God or it would cost him. And when Nebuchadnezzar ignored that warning, sure enough, he got struck with what the medical science calls boanthropy. He got a mental kind of a disease that caused him to wander in the fields and live among the animals and to be silly, to be just ridiculous, just out of mind for a long period of time. 7 years, actually. Now, some of you all remember that King George III, he was the one who was the king when we started this country, went through the same thing. There was a movie out a while back called The Madness of King George. And this has happened down through the years to different people. And, you know, there's lots of theories about why it happens and stuff like that. But in any case, this is what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And so for 7 years, he lived in the field like a donkey, eating and grass and just out of sorts. And because of the faithfulness of Daniel and the men around him, his kingdom remained intact. And so when he came out of it, after 7 years, he was able to restore himself to his throne. And at that point was when he wrote the fourth chapter of Daniel, which was then included in this book, giving Yahweh the praise of being the Most High God. So he says to him, your grandfather went through all of this. And this is probably something that Belshazzar would have witnessed part of. He very, very easily could have been a young man when all this was going on. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this, but you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and you have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you've praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron, wood and stone, which you did not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways, you have not glorified. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. So he said, you knew that, you should have known. If you weren't there to witness it, you should have been told about this. This is not something that you that people don't know about in the family. And you should you were responsible for this understanding that the God of heaven and earth, the one who puts breath in your body, Yahweh, the Most High God, humbled your grandfather, the most powerful man who ever lived, kept his kingdom for him during that particular time, which is sort of unheard of. I mean, the enemies would have moved in pretty swiftly if it hadn't been for the strong people around him protecting him and protecting his throne, Daniel being the second in command. And then restored him. You knew this story, and for some reason it didn't register with you, and you were presumptuous enough to think that you could go take those things which belong to Yahweh and you could use them for one of your licentious, drunken parties. And that you could use them to honor false gods with these things. And that's why the handwriting is on the wall, he said. Nebuchadnezzar repented, but Belshazzar became haughty. Nebuchadnezzar honored God, but Belshazzar dishonored him. The writing was on the wall. It was written by the very hand of God. Then Belshazzar gave orders. And they clothed Daniel with purple and put out a necklace of gold around his neck, issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. That same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean was slain. So Darius the Mede, or who's Cyrus the Great, received the kingdom at the hand of the age of 62. Now there's a piece missing out of here. What we're missing for some reason is verses 24, 25, 26, 27. Which I can fix that. But all right, so here's what it says. So the hand was sent from him, and the inscription was written out. This is what he said. Now this is the inscription that was written out. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Mene, this is the interpretation of the message, Daniel says. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales and found deficient, and Upharsin or Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given up to the Medes and the Persians. Now, Upharsin, if you look at the word there, you see that in the middle of it is the word Farsi, which is the language of the Persians, if you're into that sort of thing. So it basically says Mene means that your kingdom is going to fall. Tekel means you have been weighed and found wanting, and Upharsin, the Persians are going to take over your kingdom for you. And because the Mene was written twice, it means that it is assured. In other words, you can't repent from it. This is a decision. It's a done deal. It's just one of the kind of rules of prophecy in the Bible, that the repetition of the word is given for emphasis, which means that it is it's a done deal. So that is the prophecy. And for some of why it's not in the book, I don't know. But at any rate, so that's what he said. The handwriting on the wall said, you have been weighed and their kingdom is being taken away from you. You've been weighed and found wanting, and the Persians are going to show up. Now Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck, and he issued the proclamation that he would be the third in the kingdom, because that's what he said he was going to do. But that same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, Darius the Mede is also Cyrus the Great. And that's because in these ancient times, even in Jesus' time, people had more than one name. The reason is because of the cultures, the way they run together. Peter, for instance, was also called Cephas. He was also called Simon. It depends on whether you're talking about him in Greek or Aramaic or Hebrew, or if you're using a nickname. Barnabas whose name was Jonas. Joseph was called Barnabas. So you have these people who are these kings of these various cultures, and what they have is a name in each culture. For instance, Ahasuerus is in the Persian is known to us in the Greek as Artaxerxes. So that's very common in this particular time frame. My name is Billy, but they call me Wayne. So it happens. When they call me Billy Wayne, I hire a hitman. But that's so Darius the Mede or Cyrus the Great from Persia received him at the age of 62. Now, what happened here was this. Nabonidus had been out fighting against the Persians and the Medes. And they had been growing in strength, and this was the point in time at which it was all coming to a head. And the Persians and the Medes defeated Nabonidus. But the information had not yet gotten back to the Chaldeans until just about this time. Belshazzar, who was doing what he usually does, which is party like crazy, was figuring that he would be safe from all of this. This would be fine. This was kind of like in Europe and in England during much of their time frame. Everybody who was king everywhere was related to everybody else. There was a whole bunch of intermarriage and these things for alliances. And so, you know, one guy's enemy is also your uncle and that sort of thing. So Belshazzar didn't think he had anything to fear. He obviously hadn't heard about Nabonidus' defeat yet. And so what happened is that he didn't pay attention to it. Now, who did pay attention to it was the city elders. Babylon was an extraordinary place. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon was one of the seven wonders of the world. Nebuchadnezzar had built it as a tribute to his god and to his wife and created this extraordinary place. I forget exactly what the width is, but they said you could race chariots seven abreast around the ceiling or the walls, the top of the walls of the city. Now, cities in the ancient days were, the walls were actually thick. There were rooms. People lived in the walls. The walls were so wide that you could have, there were houses in them. If you've ever gone to San Antonio, Texas, and you've gone to see the real missions there, the one like San Jose or Concepcion, one of those real missions, you can see that the walls are where people live. They lived in the walls. That's how thick they were. The outer walls had no windows. The inner walls had windows, and people lived there. At the Alamo, all the Alamo is, so we lived there for a long time, all the Alamo is the magazine and the church. It was the place where they kept the gunpowder, and it was the church. All the rest of it's gone. The real battle for the Alamo was fought in Woolworths. All of that was gone. But if you go out to San Juan, that's not right. San Jose, thank you. If you go out to San Jose, the Mission San Jose, which is the one that's the best preserved, and it's right around the corner. All these missions were like 9 miles apart. They had to be by design. But at any rate, so if you go out there, it's still functioning. There's a Catholic church still working out there. People go every Sunday. There are people who live out there, not in the walls, but they live in the church. They still work the gardens out there. And when you go in there, you go inside, you can see that the walls, when you go inside the walls, this is where people lived. They held meetings. They slept. They ate their food, all of this. They cooked their food outside on orns or a little oven-like things. But they did their living in the walls. And so Babylon and cities like this were much, much more grand than that. And Babylon was so huge and so big, so monolithic, that it was reported that you could race 7 chariots abreast around the top of its walls. That's how big the walls were. At Babylon. And so it was a great and mighty city. And the elders of the city were proud of it. And they were far more proud of the city than they were of their king. And the last thing they wanted was for this Persian horde under Cyrus, or Darius the Mede. Remember, the Persians and the Medes are actually relatives, and the Medes, who were initially kind of in control, were taken over by their younger cousins, the Persians, and so the kingdom of the Persians and the Medes sort of blends together. We'll get into that some more as we get into Daniel. They had just finished conquering the earth, and the last thing that the elders of the city of Babylon wanted was for them to come in and tear up their city. And so they solved the problem by opening the gates and letting them in. That night, without firing a shot, Cyrus the Great waltzed into Babylon, went through, gathered up the royal family, and did what you do to royal families at that particular point in time. And Belteshazzar met his end. Now, let me stop and get comments or questions or rebuttals or what? Yes, sir. Babylon? No, Babylon's been raised. It's around 30 miles outside of Baghdad. And it's been flattened out. They are, such as I was saying, put a lot of money into trying to get it back up. And those people in Iraq today who see a future have plans to restore it, because if they can get it back up and going, it would be a great tourist place. Of course, there's a whole lot has to change in Iraq before you're going to get a lot of tourists over there. But the long-term plan would do that. Now, Saddam Hussein, one of the reasons he attacked Kuwait was to get the money to finish Babylon. Because he raised up a lot of the walls and raised up a whole bunch of the sites and all that sort of thing. I mean, there are people who talked about building a theme park over there and all that kind of stuff. There's a book that includes some of this information by a guy named Rosenberg. What is his first name? Huh?
Joel Rosenberg,
and it's called Epicenter. Which is a very, very interesting book, by the way. I don't agree with everything he says, but that doesn't make him wrong. But he talks a little bit about some of this. You can get that. But Babylon is about 30 miles outside of Baghdad. It's been pretty much a waste for a long, long time, until Saddam Hussein came and started rebuilding, or tried to rebuild it. It's been sort of looted again. People, now that nobody's mining the store, whatever was of value in there has been kind of stripped out. But it's still, if they can ever get their country underneath their feet, one of the things they would do is to restore Babylon, which plays into the thinking of a whole lot of people who are into end time prophecy. Other comments?
Just sort of on human nature, grandson. You know, the grandfather pays all the dues, learns all the lessons. Mm-hmm. The son doesn't get any of it. We don't know. You'd think he would teach him. They didn't teach the son. And it's not like this is the only time it happens. It seems like, you know, as you read the movie, it happens over and over and over again. You know, they come back to God, then they fall away, they come back, they fall away. He sees a hand on the wall, and he says, you know.
Well, actually, when he saw the hand on the wall, his hip joints went slack. So,
but he didn't change his behavior. So, really,
well, he didn't have to. He died the same night. No, he didn't have a chance to. But let me comment on that, because I understand your point.
How about today? I mean, you know, it's still going on, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I want to comment on it, because to be fair, we're worse than they are. To be fair, somebody like King David, or King Solomon, or almost any of the kings of that day, and Belteshazzar, and Nabonidus, and Nebuchadnezzar, all those people, they had many wives. And they might have 50 sons. Well, you don't take 50 sons to Cub Scouts, you know. This is those kind of kids are raised up in groups and schools and whatever. And almost from the time they're born, there is a whole group of people surrounding them, maneuvering to take over the throne when their father dies. And you get this jockeying for position. And so the relationship between these fathers and their sons who take over is very often, at best, distant. Sometimes it's hostile. Nebuchadnezzar would have been somebody that he wouldn't have seen him very often. Or Nabonidus either. Nabonidus, who is actually his father, has been off in battle for so long, you know, that, if you read the story in 2 Samuel, 2 Kings, about David and his own sons, what you get is that you get Amnon trying to take over. You get Absalom killing Amnon, trying to take over. You get all this, and you get the various mothers jockeying for position, including Bathsheba. And Bathsheba reminds David how much he loves her, and that he promised her that her boy would be king. And so David keeps his promise to her, and he makes Solomon the king. Now, what kings did in these days, when I say these days, even all the way up to more modern times, is one way to make sure that the son you want winds up on the throne is to make him co-regent while you're still alive. And that's what David did. He made Solomon co-regent in the last 10 years of his life. So Solomon was co-king during the same time. In this particular case, we see the same thing. Nabonidus is king, but he's made Belshazzar, he's made him the co-regent during the time. So they're both the king, but one of them is the king and, you know, with training wheels on, and the other one's the real one. When these big royal families, and even big rich families, if you take the Rockefellers and, some of these big, wealthy, very wealthy families, there's a lot of jockeying and stuff that goes on and all there, and a lot of politics and intrigue and whatever for the control of the company or the whatever. So I don't think, I mean, we really are more at fault than they are. I don't think that Nebuchadnezzar, who isn't trained in our way of thinking. I mean, my own father, I had issues with my own father because he worked all the time. He was never home. And when I grew up and became a father, I learned some things. And one of the things that I realized after I grew up and became a father is that my dad was not raised to take me to Cub Scouts. That was not what his generation did. His generation went out and made a living. They made sure there was food on the table and clothes on your back, and they made sure that you got to school and that sort of thing. And my dad worked, you know, 6-7 days a week, and he would work long, long hours. And on Sunday when he was home, he'd cut the grass and stare at the television, whether it was on or not. He would just veg. And so for me to take my present understanding of what a father should be and superimpose it back on my dad was wrong. And it took me a while to figure that out. He did exactly what he's trained to do, and he did it very, very well. Didn't mean he didn't love me, and I can't put my expectations on him fairly. And so for us to look back to these people and say, gee, they were really kind of bad fathers. I don't think that if David and Solomon had a lot of good time together talking about God, it would be atypical. Typically speaking, what happened is other people were given assignments to raise this boy. Now, when we get to Isaiah, we're going to see that right away. In the year King Uzziah died, 742, Isaiah begins to prophesy. And Isaiah is a member of the royal family. And Isaiah, as a member of the royal family, his assignment is to tutor and mentor young Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, grandson of Uzziah, and his father Joram was in between them. Joram got leprosy and couldn't reign, so Ahaz moved up, and Hezekiah, his son, moved up after him. But only by the grace of God. And by the grace of God, Isaiah had been chosen to mentor Ahaz, or he wouldn't have been the good king that he was. And the fact that he was even survived to be king was the grace of God because of all the stuff that's going on in the families there. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, this is a problem with us. Another example that's back in here that's more to your point is Samuel and Eli. Eli preached to the whole world while his kids went to hell. When you read 1 and 2 Samuel, you'll see the same thing. Samuel was the last great judge of Israel, and his sons were worthless. Eli was a good man. His sons were worthless. And so that speaks to your point as well. But these guys here, Samuel and Eli were men of God. They were men who had reason to think that they ought to behave in this way. These guys were ruthless, pagan. They were not Judeo-Christian. Their offspring were for eating. You take a guy like Jacob, for instance. Jacob has 12 sons. What he actually has is 2 sons and 10 laborers. And they are so in tune with that that they have great hostility toward his other sons. Their mother, the 6 sons of Leah, are watching their mother be disrespected year after year after year, even though she's knocking out sons like a very productive woman would and should be getting all the honor and glory. And, Rachel, whom he loves, can't get it together. So they see all of this. And when in the process of talking among themselves in Genesis about Joseph, they're going, let's kill him. If we kill him, we have a chance to actually get what belongs to us when our father dies. If not, it's all going to go to him, and we're going to work for him the rest of our life. And we can't stand him. So sometimes I don't think we realize how much we've been influenced by Judeo-Christian thinking. The fact that we love children the way we do is new to the world. In fact, remember that when Jesus was on the earth and the little children came to try to get around him because they were attracted to him, the apostles were busy pushing them away. And why? Well, because it was not common for young children to come into the presence of adult males in Hebrew society. Until you were 12 years old and bar mitzvahed, you weren't even supposed to be in the presence of them. And if you were in the presence of them younger, you were supposed to be quiet. Jumping up on their lap was just unheard of. Now, at home, behind closed doors, maybe. And certainly you've got a respected Rebbe around, and all these kids are coming up, and the apostles are going, go away, go away, go away. And Jesus, surprising them, says to them, suffer the little children to come unto me. Allow. The word is translated suffer in the King James. And the reason is because it has the tone of permit this abuse to happen. Suffer it. Put up with this. Whatever. Because Jesus doesn't see it as an abuse, but they do. And so he says, permit it to happen. And so he embraces them and whatever. Well, that's a learning experience for his people. And from all that flows, what we have. In the Old Testament, men loved women who could produce sons. Why? Labor. This is an agrarian society. It is a society that requires a lot of hands to get things done. You can hire them or you can bear them. Which one's cheaper? It's hard to know sometimes. But they, or you can buy them as slaves. I mean, there's different things you, but, they didn't have the kind of warm and fuzzy, kind of feelings about children that we do. Is that helpful or not?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay.
But I get the feeling in Jewish culture, mm-hmm, that there is a kind of a nurturing sort, mm-hmm, of thing. Isn't there a proverb that says, you walk with your children morning and noon and night and teach them?
What you're doing there, yes, but what you're reading your own sense of fuzziness into it. And I don't blame you,
yeah.
Okay? That is Deuteronomy 6. It's not a proverb, but it's Deuteronomy 6. And it says, these are my laws.
Way back then, yeah.
Yeah, these are my laws. And you shall teach them to your children in the morning when you rise, and as you walk about the day, and as you sit down to eat, and at night as you go to bed, you shall teach them. It's not a warm and fuzzy thing. It says you have a responsibility to make sure they learn it. And that means they get up during the day, when you sit down for meals, and at night. It is your job to train these children so that they will follow after me. It's not as warm and fuzzy as you're reading into it. And but it doesn't make it wrong. It's just But Jesus did a number of things that were atypical. He embraced women, and I mean he embraced them in terms of allowing them to have open fellowship with him. He was seen with women that most people wouldn't be seen with. He was willing to speak to a woman alone, which was a real no-no. The woman at the well at Sychar. He embraced prostitutes. He embraced tax gatherers. Matthew was a tax gatherer. A tax gatherer in Jesus' world was a Jew who was working for the Romans to collect taxes on behalf of the Romans. And the reason he was important, he was a Jew, is because he knew all the villagers and where they kept their stuff. So they would hire him. He was a brigand. He was considered to be the lowest of low because he was basically ratting out his neighbors concerning their goods and stuff like that. So Zacchaeus and Matthew, tax gatherers, were considered lowlifers. And when Zacchaeus had a party and he invited a bunch of tax gatherers, publicans, to come to his house, that's because that's the only people that come. They hung out among themselves because nobody else would hang out to do with them. So Jesus was atypical in the sense that he embraced the marginalized, people that other people would not, and basically said they have worth and they have value. We've chased a rabbit, but it's been fun for me. I hope you enjoyed it. Has it been good for you?
You've talked about adoption before, and from the pagan standpoint, we're using the Nebuchadnezzar and a couple of these kings. Were they still? Does that apply?
The concept of adoption applies back here as well. When a man had sons or children, but mostly sons, just because he bore children doesn't mean that he was their father in the sense that we are. He was their progenitor, but he wasn't their father. How many of y'all ever seen Lonesome Dove? Do you know who McCall is? He's the ranger played by Tommy Lee Jones, and he's like ice. He's just like, he's got no emotion whatsoever. He's very rigid, very law-abiding, the whole nine yards. And he has a son that he picked up along the way with a town prostitute, and it's his son, but he won't acknowledge him. He won't acknowledge him. And part of one of the underlying themes of the whole thing in Lonesome Dove, even if you go back to the prequels, is Newt's struggle to try to get recognized by his father. So Carl won't acknowledge him. So even in this world back here, men had children, but they did not acknowledge them until it suited them to do so. And many men adopted their children, if they were going to adopt them at all, when their children were adults. They would wait to see what kind of children they turned out to be. Up until then, they were just members of the community with no particular set of benefits. They were just their wife's offspring.
So who would, if you've got a lot of children running around, and specifically we'll just pick up the guy, who would raise them up back to which point?
Harems. Harems and people who are assigned, like, if you've got 40 children, the chances are you've got more than one wife. So the mothers would pretty much take care of their own children. And in the case of these kings and everything like that, there was always mothers and spare mothers and others. They were raised young in that regard. When they got to be a certain age, they came into the hands of pedagogues, or people who would teach them, people who would start learning the reading and writing and how to do things and that sort of thing. And so they would wind up in schools. And then if they were fortunate, they'd get a mentor of some kind who would train them. If they were unfortunate, they'd wind up going into a trade and they'd wind up learning under somebody like that. And, a lot of them, they wound up in the military. So sometimes their relationships with their natural father were somewhat at a distance, if not altogether at a distance. But when a king chose a successor, he went through the same process as adoption. He said, this is my successor. I grant him all of my power. I grant him all of my wealth. I grant him all of that sort of thing. So the process of adoption in the ancient world goes all the way back that far.
Wayne, what about through the Old Testament, and when they have many children or sons and stuff, and the difference between their blessings and their inheritance.
Yeah, you're talking about Jacob and Esau. Well, in the case of Jacob and Esau, you're talking about Jewish children. And now you're talking about something that's Hebrew. In the Hebrew culture, what they believed was is that a person had, they had the firstborn, or the one chosen to be the firstborn. Because if you take a look, many of the, Jacob was not firstborn. Joseph was not firstborn. Many of the people who were supposed to be firstborn weren't. Reuben, who wound up leading the tribe, was not firstborn. I mean, not Reuben, Judah was not firstborn. But whoever was chosen to be the firstborn, and the firstborn often would be the firstborn, but often not. And the word firstborn, first does not always mean in order. Sometimes it means in preeminence. Okay? So whoever was chosen to be the firstborn was given a physical inheritance. But in the Hebrew world, there was also a blessing that was given to the firstborn, in which they asked God to imbue them with the dew of the earth and the whole nine yards. And typically, they would fall on the same person. They would fall on the same person. In the case of Esau, he wanted the physical inheritance. He couldn't give a flip for the blessing. He wasn't into that kind of thing. Esau was a man's man. He was a hunter. He liked women and hunting. That's what he liked. And Nass Camel. He liked Nass Camel. You know, if he could get into that, he would. That's who Esau was. He was a good old boy and a nice guy. By all accounts, a nice guy. He just liked his women and his hunting and his other entertainments. He didn't care a flip for spiritual things. So when he got hungry one day, and his nice little brother Jacob was making some soup, and Jacob was a wussy. I mean, if you look, Jacob was raised up by his mama. And his mama did all his thinking for him for a long, long time. God put Jacob through 20 years of hell to make a man out of him. If you read the story, okay? So at any rate, he comes in and Jacob is doing what Jacob does. He's making a good bowl of soup. He's good at it. He can do this soup. He's good at it. So he's got his apron on. He's making soup. And Esau comes in and he goes, "I'm hungry. You know, feed me." And he's going, "I'm making this soup for me. He says, I want some of that soup." All right, I'll tell you what. You give me the blessing of the firstborn. You give me that and I'll give you the soup. And Esau says, "What have I got use for a blessing? Give me the soup." The soup he was eating was a red pottage. And so therefore, he was nicknamed after that point in time Edom, which means red. He was also ruddy in complexion. But his nickname was Red. So if you were around Isaac's house, this is my son Jake and this is my son Red. So he didn't care about the blessing. He didn't care about the spiritual side of things. He wanted the physical inheritance. When he lost the physical inheritance, then he began to care about everything. And at that particular point in time, when it became obvious that the inheritance had passed to Jacob, at least legally, truth is Jacob never got it, and Esau wound up with it. But yeah, nonetheless, when it became obvious that Isaac had made the decision and adopted Jacob by the ceremony that they use, and had given him the blessing, Esau says, "Well, give me the blessing." It's kind of like, it's a blessing. You know, just say the same thing over me. Let's undo this. Let's fix this. And Jacob says, "I can't give you that blessing. The best blessing I can give you is that you're going to dwell away from the fat of the land. You're going to serve your brother and the whole nine yards. But the good news is one day you'll be through it, rid of him. One day you'll get him off your back." So that's all things. So there was in Israel there was a blessing, a spiritual blessing, and that would not have been valuable in many other of the kingdoms there. Answer your question?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the usage of the word Israelite, Hebrew, Jewish. Is that all in one and the same?
Yes, ma'am. There was a man whose name was Jacob. And at one particular point in time in his walk with God, he and God had a wrestling match. And, he prevailed in the wrestling match after a fashion. He came away limping from it, but he was able to prevail in the wrestling match. And that's another whole story, whatever. At that particular point in time, he was renamed Israel, or who wrestles with God. Okay. So he was named Israel. So he was now known, we were talking earlier about people having multiple names. So he's now known as Jacob, and he became known as Israel. So what happened is that his descendants became known as Israelites. Israelites. Now, they were in a lineage of Abaru, which means that they were Hebrew. So they were both Hebrews and Israelites. They're both the same name for the same people. When they went into captivity, in Babylon, the group that went into captivity was Judah, the tribe of Judah. And they were known as Judeans in captivity, and that word came forward as Jews.
So before Jacob was named Israel, they were Hebrew people?
Well, I'm not, it depends on, I'm not sure who would have called them that. And we call them that because of their lineage. Let's see. We got the word, I'm going to have to think. Let's see. Yeah, Joseph is referred to as a Hebrew. The young Hebrew slave that you brought has offended, came and offended me. So by that time they're called Hebrews. Sometimes it gets anachronistic. You don't know when stuff started, but and I could look it up. But let me see. I might be.
Hebrew comes from
the lineage name.
Didn't it also come from the language, the common language they spoke?
Hebrew became the language became known as Hebrew because of who they were. Yeah, we see back in, it was applied to Abram back in Genesis 14. So it goes all the way back to Abram then. It was used against, it used for him. Let me see what it says. It's like saying we speak American. Okay, then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. So, but you got to remember that Moses is writing this in 1450. He's talking about something that's happened in 2500 BC. So, whether Moses was using the name anachronistically or not, you won't know, you don't know. Okay, but they are known by all three names down through history. Anything? Yes.
Yeah. Why in the in here does it refer to Nebuchadnezzar as his father, even though it's his grandfather?
Yeah.
Genesis and throughout they'll refer to Abraham as their father and Isaac and Jacob.
All right. The Hebrew language is not exact. Hebrew language is pictorial. It has no vowels. In fact, it didn't even have vowel points until it became a written language. It was an oral language to begin with, and when it is spoken, it was spoken pictorially. So you would use words in different ways to mean different things. There's all kinds of examples of this. For instance, what does the word virgin mean in Hebrew? Well, sometimes it can mean young maiden, young wife, a wife who's had no children, or someone who's never been married. It can mean a lot of different things. The word naham in Hebrew, used in Isaiah 40, it means to comfort, but it also means to relent from punishment. So it's a pictorial language. It's like looking at something, writing on a wall. So the term Ab, which means father or ancestor or my father, you know, before that, grandfather and whatever. The reality is that Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, but he was referred to as his father and that sort of thing. And that might have been just because Nebuchadnezzar was the big dude. He was, and everybody just related to him that way. It might have been because Nabonidus was never home and that's just the way it was. But we just know from history and from the Bible that Nabonidus was actually his father, and Nabonidus was Nebuchadnezzar's son. We just know that. So, but you know, you got to get used to that. I mean, these are people who measure when they go to build something, they measure it by the cubit. The cubit is the difference between the elbow and the wrist. Okay. Now, you know, if somebody's getting ready to put together your rocket ship and they start measuring it in cubits, how do you feel about that? I mean, it's not exact. It's a rough measurement. So, you know, because my cubit and your cubit probably got a little difference to them. These are people who never built anything that had to be that exact or tolerant. So it's just the nature of the language.
Yeah. I heard somewhere that when they came in that they had diverted the water. This means, I'm talking about the Darius.
Yes.
Came in that
yes.
They diverted the water.
And yes.
Through.
Well, and that is true. That's true. But that had been going on for a while. His engineers, and this was very common. When they were getting ready to lay siege to somebody, they would, you know, they would bring a big army up and they would start doing all that. Alexander the Great conquered the city of Tyre and Sidon, which were an army, by building a huge ramp in the water all the way out from the shore, and he built it twice because it caved in. And so he just kept building it. Masada, the wall that was built to go to Masada, took him years to build. That's why the fall of the Jews took so long, because of that. So, yeah, one of the things that, according to historians, that caused the fathers of the city to capitulate and open the gates was when they saw that Cyrus had the ability to divert the water, they figured he knows what he's doing. So, you know, why let him come in and tear the town up? Other comments?
I just have a quick question.
I
know Daniel was 15 when
When he was hauled off to captivity, right.
How old was
Nebuchadnezzar?
Yes, how old was he when he hauled off Daniel? When,
in 605? Well, hang on a minute, I may be able to tell you that.
Was he a grandfather age? No.
He was a young buck at that point. He was a young conqueror at that point. I have the reigns of the kings down in here. Nancy, do you have that list of the... Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm sure it's in there. But here's... No, the one I need is in Isaiah, actually. Maybe I should get back to you on that, but
I think the only reason I asked it because I'm just curious.
In the back of the book.
Yeah, in the appendix of Isaiah, it lists all of the kings and what their reigns were. Nebuchadnezzar reigned from 605 to 562, and you know you can guess. Alexander reigned at age 18, but he was very young. Mm-hmm. But Nebuchadnezzar was probably 20-25. When he started reigning.
So he was. I think how old Daniel would be in comparison to his grandson.
Oh, Belshazzar? I tell you what, I can do the math on that, but it'll take me some time.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Belshazzar's in here. Belshazzar ruled Nabonidus.
And he came in and asked him to read the handwriting.
Yeah. Cyrus took over in 538. Nebuchadnezzar's reign ended in 562. That's just 36 years. Okay.
Do we know what kind of relationship Daniel had with his father?
No, we know nothing. No, we know nothing about that. We don't have any history on that at all.
No.
Other comments? All right, I'm going to go on then, if that's all right. Yes, sir.
As usual, I'm a fond of useless knowledge. But just so you know,
and some of it's true. Yeah.
Why the walls were.
Yeah.
The Roman chariot wheels were 2.5 feet apart.
Uh huh.
Because, and we know that today because that's how the English got the gauge of their railroads. They spaced it the same distance apart as the Roman chariot wheels, and that's how the American standard gauge railroad came to be 2.5 feet wide.
It is useless.
Well, no. That's interesting.
It's interesting.
Huh? Seven chariots times 2.5 feet wide would be, that's going to be somewhere around 17 to 20 feet.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I think they were actually wider than that, but. I mean, not the chariots, the walls. I think we're actually why that. I just know that you could race seven abreast around the walls and whatever. So I'm sure that somewhere there's a description of the Hanging Gardens that gives us all of that. All right, I'm going to move on here, okay? It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began to distinguish himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and the satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against Daniel unless we find it against him in regard to the laws of his God." Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king, and they spoke to him as follows: "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, and the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce it in injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast in the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked." Therefore, King Darius signed the document, and that is the injunction. Now, by this time, Darius is the Mede, is king over Babylon and over the whole rest of the world. And he's trying to find a way to govern all of this. And so he decides to put in three regions of 120 satraps to manage the Babylonian holdings, led by three commissioners or stewards. And Daniel is one of the three. Probably a good thing he didn't take that other job, right? Because instead of getting hauled off to be slaughtered, he's now one of the three here. But his diligence promotes him ahead of the others. Now, we see this again throughout this. The scripture says that a man or a person's gift makes way for them. That if we serve in such a way as to please the Lord, that our gifts will come before kings and people will promote us because of that. And one of the things that we see is the blessing upon the Jews that God put upon Abraham has continued down through the ages to function and work. Because no matter what you do to them, they keep rising to the top. They keep becoming prosperous and whatever, no matter what you do. So it was with Daniel. Like Joseph, Daniel the slave becomes number two governor in the realm again. Jealousy causes his enemies to look for a way of vein of corruption in him. Looks for corruption in him. They can't find it. He is not corrupt. He does what it is he's supposed to do. And so they decide the only way we're going to get him is through his religion. That's the only way that we're going to attack him. And so they laid a trap. So they go to Darius and they get him to make a decree that they know that Daniel cannot obey. And they sneak up on Darius and they, without Darius realizing what he's doing, they get him to decree that no one can worship any other god besides Darius for the next 30 days. And in these ancient worlds and whatever, this kind of stuff's common. You know, if you remember the movie The Ten Commandments, you remember that the Pharaoh Seti, who was Ramses's father, had this priest of On, who was always doing all this kind of stuff. And he was always going around saying, "Oh, great and mighty king, Lord of the gods," whatever. And Seti said, "You old windbag," you know. This kind of stuff went on all the time. And so they said, "Let's make a decree that no one can worship any other god besides you, Darius, for the next 30 days. And Darius goes, "Seems good to me." And so he signs it. And he said, "Now we need you to sign this according to the irrevocable code of the Medes and the Persians." Now, one of the things that was true among the Medes and the Persians is their kings could sign their rules in different ways. Some of them were just temporary and others were constitutional. So in other words, once you signed it irrevocably according to the rule of Medes and the Persians, it could not be revoked. And they're not the only people who've ever done this. For instance, the Catholic Church says that when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, that he's speaking for God and he's infallible. When the Pope says that he thinks that tuna fish is better than bologna, it's not the same thing. It doesn't have the same kind of bearing. So they get this irrevocable thing going, and then Darius sees the trap. It falls over on Daniel. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house, and now his roof chamber. He had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction, saying, "Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or to any man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast in the lion's den?" And the king answered and said, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. So they answered and spoke before the king and said, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention, O king, as to the injunction, to you or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed, and he set his mind on delivering Daniel, and even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. So once the king realizes that this is a plot to try to trap Daniel, he starts trying to figure out how he can get out of it. How can he work this out? But he can't, because it's an irrevocable law, and so he's stuck. And we'll see as we go along. Now, then these men came by agreement to the king and said, recognize, O king, that this is a law of the Medes and Persians, and no injunction or statute which a king establishes may be changed. And so his hand is forced. And the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, now this is King Darius, okay, who is, by my reckoning, Cyrus the Persian, okay, Cyrus the Great, the one who eventually lets them all go home, okay. Your God, whom you constantly serve, will deliver himself, will deliver you. So he says to Daniel, Daniel, I believe that your God, whom you constantly serve, will deliver you. So he has no choice but putting the lions down, but he says, I trust that your God will deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring, and the signet ring of his nobles, so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. So when the king went off to his palace, and he spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and he slept and fled, and his sleep fled from him. So he went back home. He spent the night fasting. He did not sleep, and no entertainment was brought to him. Sally, Judy, you know, whatever. No entertainment was brought to him, and so he spent the night fasting and praying this pagan for Daniel. Now, then the king rose with the dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he came near to the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel spoke to the king and said, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king. I have committed no crime. And the king was very pleased, and he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him, because he had trusted in God. Then the king gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives, into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So that's why you want to pray for your husbands, you know, that they do good things. So, God saves Daniel, and Darius punishes the schemer. Our sins are visited upon our families and our children. There's this, scriptures that talk about that. And that is because the natural cause of sin is, this is the natural cause of sin, not a vengeance of God upon sinners. If I go to jail for whatever reason, my children will be fatherless. And because they are fatherless, they will suffer all that is there. Now, it's not that God can't redeem that. He can. But the truth of the matter is that as a rule, they will pay the penalty. If I am a person given to great sins of some kind, anger, drunkenness, or whatever, and my children learn that from me, and they teach it to their children, then it becomes an inheritance down through the ages. Sin passes, and so does righteousness. Getting back to your point, Rick, that when we, if we behave rightly toward God and embrace our children and teach them, then we can pass the righteousness that God has for us into our children. But if we go, you know, children don't do what you say, they do what you do. They learn from the way you do things and how you see things and what you, I mean, when you hear your child say something that you know they learned from you, you get it. How many of you have seen The Christmas Story? The movie with the little kid, Billingsley. Remember the kid who's, he wants the BB gun, the rifle, and the whole nine yards. And his father, Darren McGavin, has got this coal furnace down in the basement that he's always wrestling with. And this is, some of you all have old enough to remember, clunkers. Okay, so his father's always downstairs banging on the stove trying to get this furnace to do right and whatever. And in the process, his father is given to profanity. Okay, well, at one particular point in time in the movie, this little kid, Ralphie, this little kid gets into a fight with somebody and he uses... No. He's helping his father put a tire back on, and he accidentally dumps all of the lug nuts up in the air and loses them. And he comes out with a profanity. "Oh, fudge," is what he says, okay? And the father looks at him and he said, "What did you say?" And then he says, "You get back in the car." And he gets back in the car and he says, "Do you know what Ralphie said?" And he whispers in the wife's ear and she screams, "Ralphie, Ralphie." And so they take him in there and she is threatening him, and she says, and she's got him eating Life Boy. Remember the soap? He's just sitting here sucking on this Life Boy, and he's having these visions. He's having visions of coming back later in life, all blind and whatsoever. And they're going, "Oh, Ralphie, what happened?" And he said, "It was the Life Boy." At any rate, what happened is his mother's saying, "Where did you learn that word? Where did you do that?" And he's panicky. He doesn't know what to say. So he says, "Swartz told me." Okay. Well, Swartz is his friend, whatever. So the mother gets on the phone and she calls Swartz's mother. She said, "Do you know what your son told my son?" And she says, screaming in the background, and then bang, bang, bang. You can hear Swartz. He's getting beat up. And he says, the truth is that I've heard my father say that 1,000 times. He said, "My father was a veritable master of profanity. You know, he said he could rise to great heights with it." Our children reflect us. Like it or not. Yes, ma'am.
This is a funny story, but probably when I was 9 years old, I remember I was in the garage with my dad, and he was in the workshop, and he hammered his finger between two things, and he went, "God bless our heaven, God."
These guys are thrown into this, their children, their families are all cursed and brought to punishment because of their deeds, and Daniel is rescued by his God. Now, then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples and nations, men of every language, who were living on all the earth. He said, "May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And his dominion will be forever." And this is Cyrus, or Darius the Mede, or Cyrus the Persian. "He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, one of the things we need to realize is that Daniel's influence on this kingdom was vast. Babylon, he influenced heavily, but it fell. And the Persians, who they eventually fell, as we're going to see, to the Greeks under Alexander, but they lasted a long time, and their accomplishments lasted for a long time. And because of Daniel's influence, the wise men, remember, this is a kingdom full of magi, all these kind of people. The wise men respected the teachings and the sayings and the writings of Daniel, including the information that led them to the Christ child by the star. So when we see these wise men coming from out of Persia, who we like to call Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, when we see these people coming out of Persia, they're coming on the basis of the information that was in their libraries based upon what they had picked up from Daniel and his writings and that sort of thing. That's where they got that information, including the writings of the people that went before Daniel. Comments?
Do the historians of the existence of Daniel,
Gosh, I would think so, but I haven't really studied that to know it. We're getting to the time now when, let me tell you, the historians gave much of the Old Testament little or no credence. I'm talking about the secular historians, little or no credence at all. Until Rommel began to fire stuff at Patton, and Patton began to fire back. And what happened is it exposed all this damage in the desert. exposed sites and historical sites. And after World War II, there began to be this huge influx of archaeologists who came in to, and things were found, like Ur of the Chaldees was found, and the Hittite kingdom was found, and a lot of things which bore up the Bible archaeologically began to be found. Steles were found, big tall pylons with things written on them, that actually made reference to, like Sargon was one of the kings of the Bible, made reference to his conquering of Israel and that sort of thing. So my bet is that, and Daniel would have probably been known as Belteshazzar or something else. But my bet is you could find him, but I haven't done the work on it. I don't know. He's close enough that you could probably find him. Other stuff?
Who was he? Which of the other prophets was he a contemporary of? He lived the same time as some of the other guys.
Yeah, well, he was a contemporary of Ezekiel. You have Isaiah in 742, Daniel's in 605. Isaiah's still alive at the time that Daniel's starting. What happened is that Nebuchadnezzar carries the people of Israel off in three waves, starting in 605 and ending, I think, in about 587. And when he does, Ezekiel, in the second wave, gets hauled off into captivity and begins to live by the Grand Canal or the River Kabar, right there in outside of Babylon. And Jeremiah is left among the people because he's a nobody. Ezekiel is, again, one of the central prophets, and Jeremiah is a peripheral prophet. So Jeremiah and Ezekiel, by the time we get to Ezekiel, Daniel was long well respected but still alive in that particular time frame. Amos was 760, so he preceded all of them, probably was gone by then. Nancy, you know about this kind of stuff. Yeah, Obadiah was 586, so he would have been the same thing. He was prophesying Edom. Habakkuk was 605 to Judah. He was the same time frame. Those were the, you know, then you get a big drop off to Haggai and Zechariah and those people. So that group, probably some I mentioned, forgot. Other things?
Is that piece of paper you keep referring to in any of your publishing?
Yeah, well, actually, this is what I did was a long time ago. I was trying to figure out things for myself, and so I sat down with the Bible and went through it line by line, all the Begats and all that kind of stuff, and I began to figure out who lived when and in comparison to who and who they, whatever. And I built a kind of a big timeline on all this kind of stuff. And then when I went to the seminary, I found one's already been done by somebody else, and it was pretty much exactly the same.
Not as meaningful, though.
No, it wasn't. So I keep it around because I can't keep track of all this stuff. I mean, there's too much there.
There's a lot in your Isaiah book.
Yeah, well, this is in the Isaiah book.
Oh.
Yeah, no, that's one of my it's one of my charts in the Isaiah book. Most of that's in the Isaiah book. All the stuff with the kings and things like that.
I think it's really interesting, just like the effect of a righteous man. You know, just Daniel's effect was so incredible on so many different kingdoms. So many just ruthless rulers. And you came to know the living God.
I mean, yeah, she's right. I mean, here's a kid who starts off in raised in wealth, raised in royalty, and is really doing well. They're having great church services in the whole nine yards. And then, boom, great disaster happens, and he winds up getting made into a eunuch and hauled off into captivity. And instead of becoming bitter and angry about it, he relates to the Lord in terms of saying, Lord, you know, what next, or what I do next, or like Joseph did. Joseph refused to get down on his God just because his circumstances got down on him. And Daniel and his friends did the same thing. Now that comes by teaching. I mean, that's, you know, when we start studying about praising God in the midst of difficulty and all those kinds of things, I mean, you know, that isn't something that Robert Schuller made up. You know, that stuff's been going on for since the beginning of the Bible. So they learned to praise God in the midst of difficulty, and so here he is. He's gone through this horrible scenario, And yet he's faithful to the Lord. He trusts in the Lord. And he's working with what he's been given. He's blooming where he's planted. He's, instead of looking back, longing for home and wishing for the good old days, he's trying to make the best out of what he's got. And he's trying to play it. He's planning to play it righteously. On the one hand, he's sitting around studying all this pagan lore and everything. But on the other hand, he's refusing to eat stuff that he shouldn't eat. So that means he's like everybody. He's got to sit around every day and figure out, what is the ethical practice here? You know, is this okay, or can I do this or not do this? And, you know, he didn't have a book to go by. He's making these decisions as he goes along about to what degree can I be a part of this culture and to what degree do I stand against it. I mean, they're getting a rule that says that nobody can pray to their God for 30 days. And Daniel goes, well, I can't do anything about that. And so he goes back to his public three-a-day praying process and he goes, it'll just have to be what it is. So he's making these decisions as he goes along about what is honoring God and what is allowing him to be a witness in the world that he's in. And because of his great gifts and his faithfulness to God, God is raising him up and anointing him and bringing him to places of influence so that he is having influence on really, really bad men. I mean, look, Saddam Hussein is a great-grandson of Nebuchadnezzar and a puppy when it comes to a comparison. So imagine if you would that somebody... there's actually a guy whose name was Sada, General Sada, who was a Christian. He was in Saddam Hussein's court. He was actually the number one fighter pilot in the Iraqi army, and he was a hero. And so he was a counselor in Saddam's court, and he was the only one who could counsel Saddam against certain kinds of things. He talked Saddam out of dumping a bunch of toxic stuff on Israel at one particular point in time on the basis that the Israelites would shoot them down before they got there and it would wind up falling all over Georgia and Syria. But he was in this court. He's an amazing fellow. Anyway, the bottom line is in the midst of this hostile world, these really ugly people, he is finding a way to stand up for what's right without being overly religious about it. You know, he's just doing the right thing. And in the process, he's influencing these men for good. Now, to be fair, Cyrus the Great was benevolent as a dictator everywhere. It wasn't just Israel. Cyrus the Great believed, Nebuchadnezzar and a lot of the dictators of his day believed, that the best way to keep rebellion from coming is just to blow up the place, take everybody out, and move people from other places in. That's where we get our Samaritans, okay? Cyrus the Great took another tact altogether. He said, his attitude was, is let the people go home and establish their nationality and establish their homeland and whatever, and they will react to my benevolence. And that was the approach he took a lot of places. But he sent, under Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel, he sent the Jews back in 532 or so. Other comments? All right. Well, you've been very good. Appreciate you putting up with my usual histrionics. And by the way, we've gotten through the easy parts. We won't be going near as fast from this point on because it's now it's going to start to take a little more work. Press my prayers out of here, please.